G7, number 12A.
Today we start with another aspect of the law that we want to extract from the textbook and from the Christian Science idea. Namely, we want to see that after having defined our law through the textbook and through the 16 chapters, which give us the principle of that law, so to say, the theory of that law, and seeing that there is always a Christ behind the law, we must see that this Christ is working universally, that this Christ is naturally not only concerned with the Christian Scientist, but also that it is a law that works independent of people and of time, through all time, collectively, universally, cosmologically, but also individually. Now, this development has always taken place. We have in Mrs. Eddy's textbook that important sentence where she says that Christ's Christianity, that Christianity which has to do with the Christ, that Christ impels, so to say, on consciousness and on history, that Christ's Christianity is the chain of scientific being. So we were considering really that chain of scientific being by seeing that from the first chapter to the last chapter there was a chain that was one link linking up with the next link, building a chain, bringing thought, so to say, from the first chapter where we desire, where we want something, until the 16th chapter where Mrs. Eddy says, we shall not want, there is no more any want. So that chain is a chain of scientific being that is reappearing in all ages, Mrs. Eddy says, reappearing in all ages, maintaining its obvious correspondence with the scriptures and uniting all periods, be it in an individual period, be it the collective period, be it the universal period, uniting all periods in the design of God. So if we have a design of God in the law of the self-evolution of science, we should see that this law was operating, always is operating, and will be operating in the future. We have seen that each student, so to say, can individually follow that law. It is up to each one to make those steps that are necessary in order to develop the idea. We have not to wait until the universe agrees to it, until the universe presents it and manifests it, and we can say, yes, the universe goes along with it. We can be solitary discoverers, solitary pioneers in this realm. And so the individual matters in the first place. Each one of us is called, so to say, to go along that way of life and along that law. So the individual development is really that which is super important. Mr. Zeddy says, a Christian Science, it occupies the place at this period of which Jesus spoke to his disciples when he said, ye are the salt of the earth. So at this period, always at this period, we are the salt of the earth. It depends on each one of us, how he investigates the Christian Science book, but especially how he himself tries to follow the law and is an example for that law. Ye are the light of the world, he says. So Mrs. Eddy goes on and says, I long to see the consummation of my hope, namely the student's higher attainment in this line of life. So he gives an indication that she expects that the students is really going that step-by-step way, ascending, being receptive for a transformation, being receptive for a paradigm shift. We really should be able to go home with a sense, I want to make that paradigm shift, I'm open for it, I welcome it, I see that there is a great promise in it, and so it is up to each one really to go the way of light. Just as we have seen all through the Bible history, that there were always these paradigm shifts coming up and always bringing the people forward. Let's say we go back and think about Moses. He said, well, you have the manna of today, but go on and don't eat the manna of yesterday. Go forward. If you take the manna of yesterday, it stinks. It's not good for you. And so we see that very much in Christian Science, that we rely back on what we have been taught 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or even longer, that we rethink what we have heard so long ago. We eat the manna of yesterday. We rely on what our teacher has said, what we have read somewhere in the books and so on. We rely on that. Instead of having an open mind to say there is always something new and higher going on, and I have to be open for it and receptive for it. Also, when we read the St. John, his epistles, we see that he had a sense that there is always something new going on, especially in the revelation of St. John. I saw a new heaven, I saw a new earth we have seen, not the old heaven or the new heaven and the old earth. Both are new. Both our view of the universe must be new. We must look into the universe from the standpoint of principle, and no more from the human standpoint, no more from the standpoint of our human mind, the standpoint of a material concept, of a limited concept, of a corporeal concept, and see it, and look into the universe and always see the same old universe, a chaotic universe. Why not see, as Revelation tells us, that instead of the seven vials full of the seven last plagues, we have a law of compensation, namely in the law of love. We have a full compensation so that we can fill our universe really with divine ideas. And that's the only universe that is real and that is divine. So also John in Revelation could see a new heaven and a new earth. He was ready for a paradigm shift, for a terrific paradigm shift. Or Paul was also constantly calling out that he is a new creature, that we are a new creation, that the law of Christ has made us a new creation, so that we are dropping away the old creation, that we put on immortality instead of mortality. These are indications that right through biblical history, there was constantly that cry for a paradigm shift, for something new. That's different, again I repeat it, because I see this is sometimes not understood. This is different than a consciousness expansion. A consciousness expansion is something different than the consciousness transmutation. Consciousness expansion is adding the same atomistic truth and heap it up until you have a whole heap of atomistic truths. That's expanding it. But that's not that's not what we really want to achieve. What we want to achieve is really a paradigm shift in consciousness, where we go out from a completely different standpoint. That's a paradigm shift. Just as we had Newton and afterwards Einstein, and he made a terrific paradigm shift. And after Einstein, others came along in these centuries and brought a paradigm shift into their science. So we too should do that. It is should not be so that what we read today in the Christian Science periodical, that is more or less the same stuff as what we have been reading in 1910. Those articles are not more inspiring than they were 80 years ago. So there is no moving in that sense there. And we have to be careful that we in our consciousness are not constantly falling back to what we have learned yesterday and the day before yesterday and 20 years ago, and what we have learned as children. That's all right, that's wonderful, but we don't have to discard that, just as we don't discard Newton, but we see that for various fields of investigation, Newton's laws are no more applicable, that we need Einstein's laws and other laws, Heisenberg's laws, quantum theory, and so on, in order to really be able to look deeper into reality. So let's have that sense within us of going forward. That is a very great characteristic of John Dorley. He always gave us the sense, go on, never on. So he used to finish most of his talk and said, on we go and ever on we go. And that is something I would like to keep up as an attitude for us in our study, so that we are not trying to improve the body. He says, do not try to improve the old body. Much more to lay down the body through a better understanding of the spiritual idea. So in order to have a better understanding of the idea, we must somehow see that we make those paradigm shifts. Now, I want to show you now what has happened in the Christian Science thought in the world right from the beginning, from 1866 up to now. Do we see that the Christ has had an impact on the thought of Christian scientists, of the Christian Science thought? With the Christian Science thought, I do not mean the church or the movement, but the understanding that was brought forth in the Christian Science principle, in the Christian Science theory. And to consider that. And there we see that the Christ actually has an impact on the thought and on the attitude of the Christian Science students. And we want to see which periods we can detect where something was radically changed in the concept on the teaching of Christian Science. Again, I start with the first block, so to say, the first period that went so up to the turn of the century, from 1866 up to the turn of the century. That has a characteristic, a general characteristic, without much variations. Namely, it was the time of good thoughts. Again, we start out with thoughts. Again, what Mrs. Eddy had to do is to bring her great discovery right down to the people, to their thinking, to what they were thinking. And so she even complained that she had to do that, at the beginning people were not able really to understand her teaching, and they had to water it down to the plane of good thinking. It was a wonderful period, though it was only on the plane, on the basis of good thoughts. It was a period where people were gathering here a thought and there a thought, so to say an atomistic thought concept, gathering them, trying to investigate individual, single terms, what is meant by intelligence, what is meant by substance, things like that. Therefore, using very much the concordances, which were a great help in finding out what Mrs. Eddy said about atomistic terms, as I said, like intelligence, creator, or substance, or identity, or harmony, or government, or things like that. It was really considering atomistic single ideas, single truths. So they were working a lot with the concordance or with seeking and reading through the textbook. The concordance came a bit later than that. So really heaping up single truths upon single truths upon single truths, that was what they could consider as consciousness expansion. They expanded their consciousness. Mrs. Eddy herself tells us of that time that she didn't at once write, so to say, from the horse's mouth, receive the revelation of the seven synonymous terms. She had also a long time to discover what are the seven synonymous terms. And you can see that, for instance, when you read her first edition of Science and Health, there you will see that she uses mind always with a small m, never, or practically never with a capital M, mind is capitalized. And only in the later edition then she began to capitalize mind when she meant the divine mind. And it is interesting to see how she arrived at that conclusion, because we know that she taught the students herself, and that because she made no difference in the teaching or in the writing between mind small m and mind capital M, because in teaching you don't do that. When I teach you and say God is mind, I don't say God is mind capitalized. I expect that you translate that at once and say, if I say God is spirit, that you do that yourself and see it as capitalized term. But at the beginning she couldn't do that, so the students didn't know the difference between mind and mind. Mind small m, mind capital M, and therefore she had to go through that period, the Kennedy period, so to say, of finding out that her students were much more mesmerists than really Christian scientists, that they were mesmerizing the students, the patients, and she began to understand something about animal magnetism, which relied on mortal mind, on the human mind, of willful mind, willpower, and that made her realize that she had to make a great distinction between mind small m and mind capitalized. Also, something that one sees in the first edition of Science and Health is that she used much more the synonymous term soul than afterwards. That the synonymous term soul had a great value in the first edition, much more than in the later edition, which meant that she had to find her way also about the importance of these synonymous terms. She tells us later on that she had to wait sometimes quite a long time until a new synonymous term came to her. So it was also an educational process in her own consciousness, in her own development, how she built up the seven synonymous terms, how she arrived, so to say, at the seven synonymous terms. So you can see that that period, which was mainly built on thought, on good thinking, and on love. They had a great sense that God is love, and that therefore men should love each other, and so fulfill the biblical commands, love each other, love your enemies, and love your neighbor, and so on. And that was the general atmosphere which was prevalent at that time. The practice, therefore, relied on these fundamental insights of thinking good thoughts, on loving thoughts, on positive thoughts. So the practice was a thought practice. It was practicing thoughts, affirming good thoughts, affirming the good, denying the evil. It was, so to say, a thought transference method, that they believed in the transference of the thought of the practitioner to the patient. It was thought transference. Sent me good thoughts, sent me good thoughts at that and that time. I have an important conference there. Sent me good thoughts, as if thoughts could be sent from one place to the other place. There was not yet that sense that mind is all, and therefore without space and without time. And so we can see that the idea of practice was on a lower basis of thinking. Naturally, this is mostly benevolent mesmerism. It is benevolent hypnotism that was practiced, and perhaps even practiced today quite extensively. So it was the practice of affirming the good and denying evil. Arguments were used. It was the time of using arguments for God, for practice. In our textbook of today, she doesn't present the practice of arguments, except in one or the other place she speaks about arguments in the chapter on practice. So that we can see, just as Einstein brought a new paradigm, he didn't away with the old paradigm of Newton. If he had to lift up a weight, he knew that he had to do with Newton's theory. If he had to step out of a train, he knew the gravitation theory of Newton. He didn't do away with it, but he applied it and let it be applied to that field which to which it belongs. But he could see there is a much wider field to which we can only investigate through the law of relativity. So in the same way, we sometimes can use the arguments today just as before. I just read you out of the practice chapter where she says, the letter and the mental argument, you see, that was that first period of the last century, that the letter and the mental argument are only human auxiliaries. They are human auxiliaries. They are not divine facts. They are human auxiliaries to aid in bringing thought into accord with the spirit of truth and love. So we see here that at that time, arguments were only used as human arguments in order to become at one with God. She says, as long as we are not perfectly attuned to divine science, we still need the arguments of truth for reminders. We need them for reminders. So even today, perhaps there are situations where we can use arguments because that's perhaps the best we still can use. Say you have a fall, you have terrific pains that you can hardly put your thoughts together. Well, then perhaps the method of argument is the best that you can do, that you deny really the error and affirm the truth. You can say, I have not fallen, I have not broken my leg, I have no pain, and so on. Positively, that in God there is no accident, and in God there is no broken legs, and so on. You can use these auxiliaries still today, but at that time that was the main atmosphere for treatment. Arguments can only be considered as a preparatory step to healing through spirit. So we can see it was a preparatory step. And so we feel that this was an era of good thoughts and of loving thoughts. I didn't live in that period, so I cannot tell you this by my own authority. But John Dolly just got into Christian Science at that period, And he tells us the following thing in his books. He said, when I came into the Christian Science movement in 1902, it was a deeply religious, earnest, sincere movement. Can you see those wonderful qualities that we also have in prayer, in the chapter on prayer? It was a lovely, a deeply religious movement, an earnest movement, a sincere movement. At that time, he said, I knew God as mind, and that the outcome of mind was thought, not ideas, or spiritual thinking. That was the general tone. But it hadn't really grasped the fact of idea. So the beginning was really built on thinking, on good thoughts, on thought transference, of addressing the patient through thoughts, but has not yet touched the realm of ideas. Although, he goes on to say, although it was clearly stated in Science and Health. Now this is quite interesting, because we experience that again and again. And we will experience it also in the future. Well, we experience it still this week, that we are touching upon subjects that we have not yet really realized as being important. Though, I could quote it from the textbook. We read it. If it was in the textbook, but one didn't take proper notice of it. It is as if we would have, say, glasses. We can have clear glasses, and then we see the whole world in light. Or we can put on dark glasses, and we see the world dark. Or we can put red glasses, and we see the whole world in a reddish way. We can put on blue glasses, and again we have a different world which we see. So it depends on the glasses we put on when we read the textbook. It depends on the frame of consciousness, on the structure of consciousness with which we read the textbook. The moment we have another structure of consciousness, we read the textbook differently. And we see in the textbook something which we have not seen before, though it was in the textbook. That's the beauty of it, of a book that has been written through revelation, that it always can bring forth a new revelation, though the text doesn't change. That's, the miracle why a book like the Bible could last over thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That's a miracle. Because if you take a good book that is written today in science, or a novel, a bestseller in science or in ordinary literature, you know that after 5 years nobody talks about it anymore. It's over. It has done its job, and then a completely new frame of consciousness or structure of consciousness is at the moment at work, and therefore we see the world differently. Yes.
Thank you.